Greetings and welcome to another edition of Soundography. It's a crash course in music, one band at a time. I'm Brian Ibbett.
And I am Hammond Chamberlain.
And we are going old school today, which is a good change of pace from the last couple weeks of newer bands like Tool and Weezer and Primus and stuff like that. We're going way back here with a band. Well, not a band, the band. And we're going to talk about that aspect too. That coming up with a good name for your band is a whole different thing in 2017 than it was in the late 60s.
Yes, it definitely was. And I feel like this was more of a reflection of what they had been doing as a career and less so of a, hey, let's call ourselves this.
Sure. Yeah. Right. They probably, you know, at the time they were coming up with the name, it was probably like, well, let's just give ourselves a name just so we've got something to call ourselves. And not thinking that 40 years down the line, people are going to be saying, oh yeah, love that fourth album by the band.
Who?
Exactly. No, not the Who.
Oh, let me guess who.
No. Yes. No. See?
The.
All perfect examples. So let's go ahead and get into this. The band, it's a Canadian-American roots rock band formed in Ontario, Canada in 1968. Those original members, Rick Danko, Garth Hudson, Richard Manuel, Robbie Robertson, and Levon Helm, first came together as they joined Ronnie Hawkins as his backing group called The Hawks, Ronnie Hawkins and The Hawks.
Why didn't they stay with that?
Right, you know, unless Ronnie didn't want them using that name outside of performing with him, which I could totally see.
I could kind of see that Huey Lewis didn't want the News running off and starting their own
right, or Question Mark and the Mysterians, you know, hey, we're the Mysterians. Yeah. Where's Question Mark? he's in the audience heckling us. Anyway, but yeah, I agree. I think that would have been a much better name than the band. In 1964, they split from Ronnie Hawkins. They toured and released singles under the names Levon and the Hawks and Canadian Squire. So, well, they kind of did use it there, right?
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
Using Levon Helm as the front man, but still that Ronnie Hawkins name.
The Canadian Squires kind sounds kind of Bay City Rollers-ish.
Kind of, yeah. Or Brobdingnagian Bards, like, you know, like a like you kind of expect the Canadian Squires to come out with hats with feathers in them and pantaloons.
More of a Ren Faire rock band.
Right. Playing the lute, you know. because they had always been, quote unquote, the band for other musicians, Levon Helm figured out the name, the band, or he figured the name The Band worked. Dylan continued to work with them and again went on tour with them in 1974. Now let's talk about that. In 1965, 68, calling yourself The Band is kind of one of those clever things like The Who or Yes or Guess Who, because it's tongue-in-cheek, jokey thing. And as you're, you know, as you're coming up, it's kind of a little tongue-in-cheek joke to the fans.
Yeah.
Hey,
who
you get
are
that
you?
New album from that prog group? Yes, 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 yes.
And then it's also things like, who are you with? Oh, I'm with The Band. I mean, it's just lots of insighty, darn near Spinal Tappy jokes can be made for the circle of people who live within that arc of environment. Beyond that, it gets a little weird.
Well, and not just weird, but when you look at the day and age of internet and searching for information about music that you like, doing a search for The Band, unless you're, you know, use your Google Foo intelligently and put it in quotes or put The Band music group and stuff like that, or Robbie Roberts and The
like
Band,
I
or Levon Helm.
Like I did, The Band, Band.
The band, band, in brand, in second band in parentheses.
No, it was one. The band were capitalized, then band was lowercase,
okay.
And it was able to spit out quite a bit of information.
There you go, and a little bit easier maybe with The Band than doing a search for Yes.
Yes. Oh my gosh.
Or the is probably the worst group to try and find information on online.
Unless you named your band 403. Then that's just forbidden.
Right. Or 404, you know, a band not found. Yeah, no kidding. So great idea in the 60s, bad idea in the 2000s to name yourself something as generic as the band. But they had no idea the internet was going to be coming around in about 35 years. They had no way of knowing, no way of predicting any of that. So Garth Hudson had earned a college degree and planned to be a music teacher. He was interested in playing rock music just as a hobby, not as anything professional. Back then, the Hawks liked his style of organ playing and asked him repeatedly to join. He finally agreed under the condition that the Hawks each pay him $10 per week to be their instructor. So as a teacher, and all music theory questions during their tenure, during the band's tenure, were directed to Hudson. So that's a way of saying, well, no, I really want to be a teacher. Say, okay, how about you're a member of our group, but we consider you the teacher and we ask you questions. And
I wonder how long that went along.
Right. Yeah. Or exactly.
Because I mean, did he collect 10 bucks from each of them before the last waltz? I mean, how long did that hold up before he's like, okay, you know what? I'm just doing this.
Right. Because 10 bucks a week probably would get pretty expensive in those dry months where you're not gigging, you're not touring, you're not releasing albums. It's like, all right, I need my 10 bucks from each of you.
Well, yeah. Like that story they told about playing at, who's his name? Jack Ruby's bar in the last waltz.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, I'm sure they didn't have the 10 bucks to spare that week.
Probably not. Yeah, exactly. And when does it become overstepping for him to say, music theory dictates that you follow that A minor chord with a D major chord.
Give me 10 bucks.
That'll be $10. Here's an invoice. Blues singer John Hammond Jr. recommended the band to Bob Dylan after he'd worked with them on his record So Many Roads. And in 1965, Bob Dylan hired them for his tour. After the tour, they moved with Dylan to New York, where they did some informal recordings that became the official album, The Basement Tapes. Most of their concerts were met with heckling and disapproval from folk purists. Dylan also reportedly consumed a significant amount of amphetamines. Some of the band joined him, but not all of them. The poor reception negatively affected Levon Helm, who left the tour and spent much of his time working on an oil rig in the Gulf of Mexico. After the tour, they attempted to record together, but only one usable single was produced, and that was Can You Please Crawl Out Your Window?
Which is an odd, that's got to be an odd song. I didn't listen to it, but.
Oh, I like that one a lot.
Is that on, that's not Bob part Dylan of the band. Tune. Yeah, it's a Bob Dylan tune. So I didn't go back and dig through it, but it's that's an odd title of a song that says so many things without really saying anything.
Well, it does. And it is funny. Can you please crawl out your window? Like asking instead of being like the Romeo, where at that, come on out, Juliet, crawl out your window, would you? It's like, Transvision Vamp does a great cover of that song. There's another band we need to put on our list, but, they do a great, almost punk rock version of that song. And that kind of is the deal. It's like, can you please crawl out your window? It's okay. You know where you're going to, or something like that.
I was only throwing.
Now I feel like I'm doing Mr. Tambourine Man lyrics in there as well.
I was only throwing rocks at the glass. I swear I won't throw them at you.
Right. Can you please open your window now? I'm done throwing rocks. So Robbie Robertson was featured on the album Blonde on Blonde, the Bob Dylan album Blonde on Blonde, but none of the other Hawks were included as part of that. The Basement Tape recordings became the basis for that first album. The Basement Tapes were released partially later in 1975 and a complete set of them in 2014, about 6 or 7 years after the first album. The Hawks rented a big pink house, it's going to come up, near Woodstock, and started writing their own material there. Initially, they wanted to be the Crackers or the Honkies, but the label shot those ideas down.
Those would be much easier search terms in 2017.
Right, yes, exactly. Which is funny. I mean, there's a Cracker. There's a band called Cracker, but not the Crackers.
Yeah, not the Crackers.
The Crackers. So, music-wise, before we get to that first album, music-wise, these guys, for me, kind of occupy a very similar space to Youngbloods and the Grateful Dead. It's kind of like they're more where the Grateful Dead are this kind of style, but more acid and PCP and marijuana. These guys feel like moonshine whiskey rock.
Yeah. Well, it was interesting because when I was watching The Last Waltz, I realized that I kept drifting off to my love of Three Dog Night. And I think that they kind of are in the same kind of box in a way, where all the members can sing, all the members are good musicians, kind of rootsy, kind of good stories, not, you know, lots of things going on, but very general and inoffensive kind of music.
Nothing challenging to the listener that is going to turn them away, but still interesting melodies, if not intricate melodies.
Yeah. You're never going to hear a protest song, but you will hear something that'll make you think.
Right.
Or enjoy.
Yep. Oh, wait a minute. Yeah. I enjoyed it.
Yeah.
All right. So the first album came out in 1968 called Music from the Big Pink. Again, this is in reference to that Big Pink house that they rented near Woodstock in New York and started writing their own material. Woodstock, New York, or Woodstock, Georgia?
Woodstock, New York. It was right outside Woodstock, New York. Yeah. What's weird, though, is that Mellencamp actually broke that down and made multiple little pink houses.
Little pink houses. Yeah. That's right. Chopped them up into little bits and put them on the hillside with those other little boxes. When the album was first released, it was widely acclaimed. It contained three songs that were co-written by Bob Dylan: Wheels on Fire, Tears of Rage, and I Shall Be Released. The song The Weight was used in the movie Easy Rider and easily has become their best known song. It's the Take a Load Off Annie and Take a Load for Free, which there's an example of when you've got multiple musicians, multiple vocalists in a band and having a song where each of them kind of go up and take their turn singing a verse.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Which I really like. And I'm trying to think of good other examples of that. I guess you get we mentioned Level 42 earlier, but Something About You has both Mark King and Mike Lindup sharing vocals. Sure, but that's not a great example.
I'm sure Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young did it.
Oh, yeah, right.
And I can't think the Beatles probably didn't do it.
They would have had to do something like that. I'm thinking about it, though. I mean, that last batch of songs at the end of Abbey Road, if you count those all as kind of one big monster track, then yeah, I mean, you've got everybody but Ringo singing in that bit.
Styx, multiple vocalists.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm sure once this gets released, we'll have thought of some, and I'm sure our listeners will be able to post some other ones in the show notes. But that's interesting, especially when you've got, you know, in these guys' case, four or five different vocalists all doing vocals.
Yeah, you've got the drummer doing songs, you got the guitar player doing it, you got the keyboard player, the pianist doing stuff. I mean,
right.
Everybody sings.
Everybody sings in this one. While a continuity ran through the music on the album Music from the Big Pink, the style varied song by song. They went on tour, making a stop in 1969, a little-known show called Woodstock. Their performance wasn't included in the Woodstock film, though, due to various legal reasons, which is a bummer.
Yeah.
They left for Los Angeles to start the next album, which was called The Band, their self-titled second album, 1969. From their rustic appearance on the cover to the songs and arrangements within, the album stood pretty starkly contrasted to other popular music of the day. The band featured songs that evoked old-time rural America, like references to the Civil War, for example, The Night They Drove Old Dixie Down. To farm workers in King Harvest Has Surely Come. Rolling Stone lavished praise on this album in this era, giving them more attention than perhaps any other group in the magazine's history. Grail Marcus's articles contributed to the band's mystique. The band was also featured on the cover of Time magazine back on January 12, 1970.
Yeah, I think we've talked about how they were one of the most covered groups in Rolling Stone history.
Pretty close. I mean, Bob Dylan, I think, and the Beatles have their numbers up there. But the band, when you look at all these covers, and they do a fair amount of covers on their stuff as well. I mean, one of their albums, Moondog Matinee, is almost entirely covers. We'll talk about that in a minute as well. But yeah, I mean, you look at how many people have covered The Weight and The Night They Drove Old Dixie Down and Whispering Pines and all these great tracks. Mm-hmm. And in many cases, they're covered so well that people don't know that they were originally done by the band.
And that goes back to that idea that we've talked about in the past about good songs are good songs really no matter who does them.
Regardless, yes, right. This, by the way, this album, the self-titled album, I think out of all the albums I listened to, including the all-cover album, this was the one that I enjoyed the most from start to finish. This was like all killer, no filler for me. It felt like from one track to the next, Jawbone and Whispering Pines and Lookout Cleveland, which again, you know, half the lyrics talk about Lookout Houston, the storm's coming. It feels very timely to be listening to that right now.
Yeah.
But really, really good album. Eric Clapton, George Harrison, speaking of the Beatles, said that the band had a major influence on them in the late 60s and early 70s. And it was part of the release of the band, the album The Band in 1969, that got them embarking on their first headlining tour. The next year, they released the album Stage Fright. You could kind of tell the anxiety of fame with them as the group's songs turned to darker themes of fear and loneliness and alienation. The influence on this album, on Stage Fright, is self-explanatory. The album was engineered by Todd Rundgren and recorded on a theater stage in Woodstock. After the release of this album, they joined the Festival Express with Janis Joplin and the Grateful Dead.
Woo, woo, chicka-chicka-chicka.
Natural fit for all of them there. Robbie Robertson began exerting control over the band, causing some contention between he and Levon Helm. Helm claims that Robertson was pushing his ideas in greed, while Robertson claims that his increased efforts were because Helm, Danko, and Manuel were becoming more unreliable due to their heroin usage. Robertson insists that he did his best to get Manuel writing more songs, only to see Manuel slip deeper into addiction.
It's interesting how this happens when you have a lot of creative voices. I mean, when you take like bands like Kiss, where you have Gene Simmons and Paul Stanley being the writers, and then they just basically, well, they did have other band members, you know, but nowadays you could just pull in any two other people and they could put the makeup on and be Kiss as long as those two guys were there.
Which they kind of do. They kind of have done with the drummers. I mean, Peter Criss, of course, the first one, and then there've been a couple.
Eric Carr and a few others.
Eric Carr, yeah. right. But
when you have a band like this, and they're kind of dependent on each other, that creative fighting will sometimes start. And then you add in addiction and all that kind of stuff on top of it. It starts to get really dicey. And and you can tell that from here down, the band really starts to slide
on shaky ground. Yeah. Happened with Lennon McCartney, happened with Difford and Tilbrook, happened with, did for a while happen with Simmons and Freely, or not Freely, but, what's that?
Paul Stanley.
Yeah. I was thinking, for some reason got Ace Freely in my head and couldn't get it out. But yeah, I mean, you get those, it's like a marriage, you know, when you've got a band and there's two primary guys doing the music and lyrics, the fights are going to erupt because you're translating the other person's vision, whether it's putting lyrics to the music, putting music to the lyrics. There's going to be fights and probably more of a judgment situation than you would get with a marriage.
Yeah. Cause there's money involved because it's a business.
Exactly. Again, you know, the releasing one album per year kind of thing continued. 1971 saw the release of Cahoots, which featured When I Paint My Masterpiece by Bob Dylan, 4% Pantomime with Van Morrison, and Life is a Carnival. You can fly off the mountaintop, anybody can. Run away, run away, run away, run away. It's the restless age. Look away. In December of that year, they recorded an Alive album called Rock of Ages, which was released the next year, 1972. They added a horn section on this album, which was arranged by Louisiana singer-songwriter Alan Toussaint.
And then a few years later, Def Leppard would co-opt that to be one of their biggest hits.
Which one?
Rock of Ages.
Rock of Ages. Different song.
I know.
Different
song. I understand.
Next year, 1973, saw the release of Moon Dog Matinee, which was an album, as I mentioned earlier, of old songs written by non-band members. All cover album and some classics on here. They didn't tour in support of Moon Dog Matinee, and the album itself got mixed reviews. They did play at the SummerSlam at Watkins Glen. It was an enormous show at a raceway. It was attended by 600,000 people, also featured the Grateful Dead and the Allman Brothers. Again, good fit for the band. They backed Dylan on the Planet Waves album, and the band and Bob Dylan went on a joint tour, where they played 40 shows in North America in 1974.
What's weird is it started on April 20th.
Right, yeah, exactly. at 4:20 p.m. later that same year, Before the Flood was released, and that album documents that tour.
What's weird is I think Snoop goes on those every time he goes out.
Easily,
yeah,
easily. By the way, and we can leave this in. Did you know that Snoop Dogg has a new game show coming out?
No,
he's doing the Joker's Wild.
No.
Yes. And what's funny is that T and I saw an ad for this, and it's basically, you know, it's the old, not Wink Martindale. Who was the guy's Jack? Can't remember the guy's last name, but the old host.
Yeah.
So he's going to be the new game show host for that. And it's a remake of that show with the spinning wheels and the
Joker.
And a triple. Exactly.
Yeah.
But they actually have monetary amounts on there that are 420 instead of $400. It says 420.
Oh my gosh.
And I looked at T and I said, why on earth did they not call this the Toker's Wild? Seems like a missed opportunity.
Right yeah. There. Oh my gosh. This sounds like something that is being done on a bet. Right. Two executives had a developmental deal with him, and they said, you know what? Let's do this and see if we can get it through.
I think that whoever came up with, I think that somebody was smoking pot and they came up like, you know, it'd be a good idea, Matt.
This is a Saturday Night Live sketch.
It really is. Totally is. Anyway, all right, back to the band. Let's see here. During the time of Moondog Matinee, the band had Rob Framboni help them design Shangri-La, which was their own recording studio.
Which is like the perfect name for a studio designed in the late 60s, early 70s.
Totally. Yeah, absolutely. Shangri-La, man. Totally. 1975 saw the release of Northern Lights, Southern Cross. It was the first album of new material since Cahoots. All of the songs were written by Robbie Robertson. And fans and critics liked the album, but it didn't sell well.
This thing sounded like the 70s.
It totally did.
There wasn't much in here. It was only missing a couple of sounds to really seal the deal. But I'm sure if you opened the CD even now, it would smell like the 70s. And then when you stuck it in the CD player, you're just transported back to like 1971.
Oh, for sure. Like that same, that very specific guitar sound from the 70s, the keyboard, that kind of Hammond organ keyboard thing that was popular back then.
Yeah, the box set comes with a case of Marlboros and a thing of high karate.
Sure. So in the book The Wheels on Fire, which was Lee Von Helm's autobiography, he said that, quote, it was the best album we had done since the band. The album also produced more experimentation from Hudson, switching to synthesizers, which are showcased on the song Jupiter Hollow. Robbie Robertson was tired of touring, and Richard Manuel had suffered a neck injury, so they had to cancel several shows in 1976. But he convinced the others, to retire from touring and came up with an elaborate farewell concert, which was called The Last Waltz. The original lineup ended touring in 1976. It was a live ballroom performance that featured a large number of notable musicians, and the event was held on Thanksgiving Day, 1976, in San Francisco. They had a horn section. They had Joni Mitchell, Neil Young, Ronnie Hawkins, Bob Dylan, Muddy Waters, Dr. John, Van Morrison, Ringo Starr, Eric Clapton, Ronnie Wood, Bobby Charles, Neil Diamond, and Paul Butterfield.
I have two comments on this.
Yeah. Yes.
My
couple seem out of place. One seems out of place.
There. Okay, but that's beside the point. One is the reach of these guys in a relatively short period of time is pretty astounding.
It really is.
I mean, when you can get on the phone and call up your buddy Neil Young and Bob Dylan and Neil Diamond, Eric Clapton.
And
you can get them to show up and do a concert. That's one thing. The other thing that I wanted to bring up was that if a bomb had gone off in that theater that night,
music would have been
a completely different landscape because everybody that was meaningful was in there.
Really was, yeah.
Film would have been different too.
Bob Dylan in there and Neil Young, Joni Mitchell. I mean, such an incredible group all in one place. It's like the president, the vice president, and everybody in like the upper tiers all in one place at one time. You just don't let something like that happen.
And then you throw in Scorsese in the mix. I mean, film would have been different as well. So, I mean,
for sure.
When you think about I didn't realize just the importance of that moment, but the nexus of creativity and influence that was happening that night is pretty impressive.
It's astounding. Yeah. And you wonder too, who's in the audience, right? Cause it's gotta be people with some connections to be able to get to see this ballroom performance. This isn't an arena where you can get tickets a little bit easier and you get scalpers out there selling it for $500-$600. I mean, this isn't a ballroom. So you know that demand for these tickets was huge. You know that that audience had to be filled with, there had to be a few luminaries.
Most definitely.
So as we mentioned, the concert itself was filmed by Martin Scorsese. They released the movie in 1978 and a 3-disc soundtrack LP or 3-LP soundtrack was released alongside it. And bottom line, The Last Waltz, if you haven't seen it, find a way to it's not streaming right now, but find a way to watch it because it's amazing. It's easily my favorite concert film. And it's not just song after song after song. There's interview segments. You see a young Martin Scorsese interviewing members of the band. Really, really cool.
So as far as ranking, this is better than the Duran Duran film?
Gosh, let me see. The David Lynch bizarro Duran Duran film concert movie thing. Yes, hands down. I mean, the only one I think that you could compare that's on this level is Stop Making Sense, Talking Heads Stop Making Sense. And that was directed by, I want to say Demme?
It might have been. I think
Jonathan Demme?
Yeah, I think it might have been.
Again, a really early, Jonathan Demme. It was a 1983 concert. They must have redone it and re-released it in 1993. Yeah, because here we go. Came out in 1984, but they did a new polished version or something in 1999. Apparently, it's playing by me at the Alamo Drafthouse Cinema on October 7th.
Ooh. It'll
be an interesting thing to see, right?
Hey, Tina, guess what we're doing?
Right, exactly. All right. 1977 saw the release of Islands. And this is an interesting one, by the way. It took me a while looking at the cover of it because you're looking at the cover and you think it's a shot of a sunset being taken through like a cove that's been carved out by the water passing through it. And then you realize that cove is made up of the faces of the members of the band. And I didn't it took me 10, 20 minutes of looking at that album cover off and on before I realized, oh, wait, those are silhouettes of the members of the band. It's really cool. This album fulfilled their contract with Capitol Records and allowed for The Last Waltz to be released on Warner Brothers. The album itself contained a mix of originals and covers, things like Georgia on My Mind, Ain't That a Lot of Love. Really, really cool collection there.
This kind of goes to my idea that the band was kind of sliding because they were increasingly adding covers. And also it shows the tension was there because less and less original material was going on.
You're never going to get that from me is that a band that throws covers into their repertoire and releases covers on their albums, for me doesn't always signify that they're losing the creative touch or that they're running out of ideas.
No, I wasn't saying that. I'm saying that between the conflicts within the band, mm-hmm. that they're having because of writing rights and money and things like that, and the fact that they were all kind of sliding into different addiction issues, it feels as if they were taking a route to have less conflict.
Mm, okay.
And instead of putting original pieces on, they were saying, oh, let's just have like four originals and then we'll do a bunch of covers. Because it's easier. Right. It's easier for them to get in the same room if there really were problems.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
I guess when I said sliding, I guess it means more like health and contention, not talent mm-hmm. and willingness to create.
Right. Yeah, I'd totally go along with that. In 1983, the band actually started touring again without Robbie Robertson. Other people from the Ronnie Hawkins days were tapped to join them in his place. And a few years later, on March 4th in 1986, Richard Manuel committed suicide in his hotel room. He was 42. He'd been battling addiction for years. He'd been sober since 1978, but he started drinking again by 1984, and that just slipped him into depression and ended up taking his life. The band appeared with Bob Dylan at his 30th anniversary concert in 1992. And then in 1993, we saw the first album by the band in several years, in 16 years, if my math is correct. They released it without Robbie Robertson as the main lyricist. It was called Jericho, and most of the songwriting was done by people outside the group. They also appeared with Ronnie Hawkins and Bob Dylan at Bill Clinton's Blue Jean Bash inauguration party.
So when I was listening to this this album,
yeah,
I Amazon. It's a strange piece of music.
I gotta pull it up now. Now that you say that, hold on, I'm pulling it up. Jericho here.
It's very it feels as if they're trying to reach back to like Toto music, you know, the Africa.
But, oh yeah,
but it's not very fluid, and I don't know if it's. I don't know. Something's overproduced and kind of off about it.
It is. It's super lush and it's a lot of instrumentation and a lot more instrumentation than you're used to hearing with the band's music.
Yeah. There's,
right. I mean,
it's off-putting because it's not the band that you'd been listening to up until about 78.
For sure. Yep, totally. The band started touring again in 93. Guitarist Robbie Robertson didn't join them. He actually found success as a music producer and also as a solo artist. They performed at Woodstock in 1994.
Do you remember that we had a conversation a few weeks back, seeing if we could remember who played there?
Yes, and like, I would not have said the band.
And do you remember the only ones we could come up with, like Chili Peppers,
Red Hot Chili Peppers, and
Blues Traveler and Nine Inch Nails? And right. We've kind of covered a lot of bands that played there now. Primus was there.
We actually have. Yeah. That is funny. Robbie Robertson appeared with the band for the first time since they broke up for their induction into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Levon Helm, who had been arguing with Robbie Robertson about songwriting credits, did not attend, however. 1996, they released the album High on the Hog. There are only two original songs on this album. The rest are covers.
Okay. The cover of this album. It looks yes. more like a. It looks like it should belong to Warrant or Mr. Big.
Totally, not the band. Yeah. It's like a. It's a puppet looking pig. I mean, almost could be, if it was made out of clay, could be a Primus album cover too. Honestly,
it kind of felt like a Mr. Big or Warrant or something. There's something very early or late 90s metal about that album cover.
For sure, and doesn't feel like that country. The look that the band had had up until then, that rustic kind of look.
Yeah.
Also featured a live track of Richard Manuel singing She Knows, at least posthumously.
The Chain Gang version on this, once again, so overproduced, and it was kind of boring as far as that song goes. It's not a good cover of that song.
That's the sound of the men working on the chain. That's the sound of the men working on the chain gang. Oh, they love the sand.
No, it's not. And you could kind of tell that the band had definitely lost their way by this point.
Yeah, it's like the producers
were
running
at least lost whatever it was that gave them that unique sound.
Yeah. I think it's more producers running them than them running them at this point.
Yes. Yes, for sure. 1998 saw the release of the most recent album by the band called Jubilation. It featured more original songs than covers, a flip of the previous release. Last Train to Memphis featured Eric Clapton. And all six members only appeared together on one track called If I Should Fail. The rest of them featured different groupings, different pairings of the original members. The final lineup was Richard Bell, Randy Chiarlante.
Yeah.
Chiarlante, Jim Weider, along with the remaining original members. Danko died in 1999 of heart failure. Levon Helm was diagnosed with throat cancer in 1998 and wasn't able to sing for many years. He did eventually regain his voice and return to performing until 2012 when he passed away. And that is where we're at today with the band.
Yeah. It's an interesting story. There's a lot of, like, up until they did the, I think the last waltz maybe should have been the end of their thing.
It certainly, I think for anyone who's a fan of the band, their unique style, their unique sound, it probably was the end of the band 1.0, and maybe they just didn't pick back up when the band started releasing material after that in the 80s and 90s.
It just doesn't feel the same.
It really doesn't. The vocal, it's funny, the vocals still, you know, obviously you recognize the vocalist Richard Manuel for a little while, but also Rick Danko and Levon Helm, but that's it. I mean, they lost whatever it was after that point, that mojo that really was working for them.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Well, tell me some statistics about the band.
All right. They were inducted into the Canadian Music Hall of Fame in 89. We've covered Rush, who's in there as well.
Mm-hmm. Right.
They were inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in 94. 2004, Rolling Stone listed them as the number 50, or listed them at number 50 on the list of 100 greatest artists of all time.
And in the middle of the pack.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And really, when you're named the band, you're going to be in the middle.
Right. It's a band sandwich.
Yeah. In 2008, they were given a Lifetime Achievement Award by the Grammys. And in 2004, The Weight was listed at number 41 on Rolling Stone's list of 500 greatest songs of all time. I actually watched that on VH1. And it's a good list. If we ever decide to do something listy like that, discussing something like that would be fun.
That would be fun because, yeah, that comes up a lot, both on Soundography and in other things that I've done Coverville-wise put together. So it is cool to kind of see. It would be kind of cool to see what the top 20 were or talk about that.
Yeah. And then in 2014, the band was inducted into Canada's Walk of Fame.
Oh, so they have like a street where they've got the equivalent, basically, stars. Are they maple leaves instead of stars that have the names of
Frankly, I don't know, but I really hope so.
I hope so, too. Now that I've said that, it's like, oh, come on. If they have it, then what are they thinking?
Yeah, they're missing something there.
For sure. All right. So you're one of the lucky few, whether you in that ballroom watching the last waltz or you saw the band in concert at one of their Woodstock appearances or whatever. You're not leaving until you hear one specific song. I think, you know, this one feels like an obvious choice, but things like Up on Cripple Creek, I'm trying to think of the other, there was another really, no, I mean, and it's not that there was another big ones.
No, I understand, but we've rarely had one that was this clear of a choice.
For sure. Yeah, the night they drove Old Dixie down, that was the one I was trying to remember. But yeah, I mean, when you think about it, there's only one thing that could be their Stairway to Heaven song, and that is The Wait, for sure.
He just grinned and shook my hand. No was all he said. Take a load off, Fanny. Take a load for free. Take a load off, Fanny.
And setlist.fm, of course, confirms that with The Wait at a strong number one, followed surprisingly by Stage Fright, The Shape I'm In. Then you start getting up on Cripple Creek, It Makes No Difference, the W.S. Walcott Medicine Show, Chest Fever. Finally, The Night They Drove Old Dixie Down, eighth on the list, amazingly enough.
Wow.
Yeah. Top covers that they do as part of their sets, obviously stuff that they've released on albums. Don't Do It, which is a cover of Marvin Gaye. Wheels on Fire by Bob Dylan. I Shall Be Released, also Bob Dylan.
That's interesting that that his autobiography is actually the name of a Dylan song.
It is. We're a co Dylan song,
yeah,
right?
It's just an interesting. Yeah. It shows the impact that Dylan had on him.
Yeah, without a doubt. All right, let's get to our playlist. This is where you can take a few of our recommendations, combine them with a greatest hits album or The Last Waltz or something like that, and find a really, really good playlist of music by whoever it is we're talking about. I'll begin with my five songs. First one is a song called Mystery Train. It is a cover, and it does come from that all-cover album, Moondog Matinee. I've always dug this song, and their version of it is probably my favorite version of the song. And it's got that, what's great about this song, and there's so many other songs that mention trains, Midnight Special, for example, and Godly and Cream have one, but it's, what's great about this one is it feels like a train. Like it's got that train, and it's almost doing the whistle, the horn, the train's horn, mm-hmm. on that part of it. Streetwalker from Islands is my number two choice. It was just a pretty much, you know, I do one of these every week where it's like all the things that you're looking for from this band, you will find on a specific song or on a few different songs.
A streetwalker in the middle of the day.
For me, the Islands track Streetwalker is a good example of that. I mean, it's hard not to say The Wait is really a good collection of what you're going to get from the band because it has every member singing.
Yeah.
But in this case, I really like Streetwalker.
I wonder if they use The Wait a lot for like curtain calls and encore so that each band member could not just sing but also be featured.
It would be their way of like saying goodbye to mm-hmm. the audience.
And
like,
introducing the band too.
Right, right. Yeah, maybe. That'd be a good way to do it, too. Atlantic City from the Jericho album. Of course, it's a Bruce Springsteen song. My favorite Bruce Springsteen song.
I actually know why you picked this one, though. It's because they don't have one about Vegas.
Down on the boardwalk, they're ready for a fight. Gonna see what them racket boys can do. Now there's trouble busting in from out of state. And the DA can't get no relief.
This is such, you know, the whole thing I love about Las Vegas, you get the opposite in the song Atlantic City, you know, where Vegas is glitz and bright lights and it feels like a nonstop party. The song Atlantic City feels to me like the gutters of Vegas, or the, you know, what happens when you step four blocks off of the strip in Las Vegas. It's dark, it's depressing, and it's super dangerous. And you're going to find, you know, people committing shady acts and crime and stuff. And that's what Atlantic City, that song by Springsteen, is kind of all about. It's about a guy who is down on his luck. He owes money to a lot of people, and the guy says, all right, here's a way for you to get out of this. It's a dangerous job. And it's basically the lead singer, the person, point of view, saying, hey, I might not come back from this, but remember, everything that dies and someday it will come back, kind of thing. It's a great, great song. And then I went to a couple songs from the self-titled album, because again, that was my favorite album front to back. Whispering Pines. Just the line, the sad line, Richard Manuel singing, I will wait until it all goes round with you in sight, the lost are found. And it is such a testament to loneliness and sadness. And it's so heartbreaking and beautiful, that song. And Jacob Dylan, Bob Dylan's son, Wallflowers lead singer, does a cover of that and does a really, really good version of that. It's really cool. And then another song, the opening track from the self-titled album, The Band, called Across the Great Divide. As sad as Whispering Pines is, Across the Great Divide almost feels like the opposite of that. They've got, in the chorus, they've got this saxophone accompaniment that goes bump ba dump ba dump bump ba dump bump ba dump bump ba dump. And it's just like this happy, almost Animal House kind of melody that's going on behind it. That I just really, really like. And so those are my five.
Okay. Well, I picked Chest Fever from the Big Pink. I really, really enjoyed the organ intro and how the organ was arranged throughout. It just, for whatever reason, I really, really enjoyed this song, and the organ had a lot to do with it.
It's that growly style organ, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a Hammond B3, probably run through an overdriven Leslie speaker, and it just sounds awesome.
Yeah.
I picked the W.S. Walcott Medicine Show because, one, I love the title, but two, it is that traveling snake oil salesman kind of pitch. Their multiple vocals to kind of tell that story of the guy coming into town and then trying to hawk his wares.
Okay.
The third one is the third man theme for Moondog.
Yes. I'm glad you chose this. This is such a great one.
It's got a really, really cool organ part that feels a little circusy, but there's more to it than that. There's more kind of a sinister undertone to it. And it's just really fun to listen to. It's like Green Onions angry.
Mm-hmm.
It's like sauteed totally green onions.
With cayenne pepper.
Yes. If Popeye sold them, they'd be called Mama's Angry Onions.
Thank you.
Then I picked Blind Willie McTell off of Jericho. This is just a good old-fashioned blues storytelling song. I am drawn to bluesy things. I like blues music in general, and this is a really, really good one.
From New Orleans to Jerusalem, I travel through East Texas, where many martyrs.
And speaking of that, I picked Crazy Mama from High on the Hog, which is originally done by J.J. Cale, and he's an amazing blues artist, and they do a really good version of it.
Really? Mm-hmm. Cool. I remember listening to that album. That one didn't stand out for me. I got to go back and listen to that one.
Yeah, I really enjoyed Crazy Mama. Oh, that's really one of the few things on that album that I did enjoy. That's a hard one to get through.
It is. Yeah, but it... mid-90s, that was, during the slide.
Yeah.
The band slide.
Yeah. All the way from New Orleans to Jerusalem, I travel through East Texas.
Very cool. This was fun. This was a good week because it, again, the band is one that you know three or four songs from, and hopefully listening to them along with us and listening to our playlists, our set lists, and the stuff in the show.
And it was a good reset from the last few weeks.
It really was. Yeah. I mean, Tool, Drive By Truckers, Primus, Weezer. We kind of there was certainly no narrow genre that we were dancing in for the last few weeks, but we weren't hopping too far from one band to the next.
Yeah.
Style and genre. And this was, boy, talk about a great reset. And I think that's going to come up again. Like, it's a good transition to go into our next group, which is Huey Lewis and the News. Oh my God, I'm loving this.
Yeah, this is a really good transition too. I mean, from the band to Huey Lewis is about as easy as you can get.
Yeah, right. I think Huey Lewis feels like if you drew a map of all the different styles, especially all the different styles of the 80s, with rock and even some blues and some new wave and stuff like that, Huey Lewis would kind of be at the confluence. Like, all those roads would kind of pass through Huey Lewis Town.
Yeah, he really was
Huey Lewisville.
He really was the kind of the common denominator for pop music in the mid 80s, because he was popular in spite of hair metal. He was popular in spite of dance. He was popular in spite of the new rise wave of hip hop and new wave. And
yeah,
I mean, he was right there in the center, just weathering the storm as Huey Lewis and his News.
And they knew how to do, enthralling music videos. The band had their chops, man. It wasn't just a little fly-by-night one-hit wonder kind of thing. So, great. That'll be a good one to talk about.
Yep.
Excellent. All right. Well, get in touch with us. We encourage you to do so. Strike that. We beg you to do so. Get us an email. Let us know what you think. Soundographypodcast@gmail.com is the email address to use. Visit us on Twitter. We're at The Soundography. We tweet on there and we reply back and read all your tweets, of course. Everything else, just go to soundography.com. You'll find all of our previous episodes and show notes to go along with each one, which include our Spotify playlist, as well as a link to where you can buy the songs we talk about, the greatest hits. This will be an easy one. There's a great greatest hits collection for the band.
Oh, I thought we were just going to give them the Last Waltz, because...
Last Waltz would be a good one, wouldn't it? I mean, it's
I feel like that would be an excellent starting place, because that's the last of the classic stuff,
mm-hmm.
and kind of at their high point.
Totally. You know what? Looking at it, yeah, everything you'd want is on here. That's the one we're doing. Okay, the Last Waltz.
And plus, you get to hear Dylan and Neil Young
and Clapton and Ronnie Hawkins. Yeah.
It's a great starting place, because if there are people you know who can help transition you into things you don't know.
Yeah, sure. That's good. There's a couple different versions of that album too, or the release, and I'm wondering if one of them's an expanded version. Yeah, there is one. There's one that's 50 tracks.
Oh.
And that's I think a newer remastered release. So, wow, do they really play 50 tracks in concert? That's crazy. 54 songs, 4 hours and 6 minutes. I guess that makes sense.
That could happen. I mean, Dream Theater plays for 3 hours nightly. It's just two songs, but still.
It's just two songs. I love it. You're also going to find our Patreon. Please support us, even if it's with a buck or two every month. We're just getting ready to send out our next shipment of swag for everybody. Here's a little spoiler alert. We've got really cool guitar picks coming. Not cheapo guitar picks. If you're a guitar player, you'll actually be able to use these. They're one-gauge acetate guitar picks that are really, really nice. So be a supporter. Go to patreon.com/soundography, and you can see the different levels that we'd love to get your support at and help support the show.
You can become our programming boss and tell us what to listen to.
You can, exactly. And we've got some of those coming up later this season as well. Also, leave us reviews wherever you want to, whether it's in iTunes or Stitcher or Spreaker or on our website or Twitter, wherever you want to leave us reviews. Tell us what you think of our show, unless it's bad, and then just email us directly and don't tell anybody else. And we'll deal with it. And we'll deal with it. We'll fix it. Perfect. All right. That is going to do it for this edition of Soundography. On behalf of Hammond Chamberlain, this is Brian Abbott saying we'll see you next time right here on Soundography.
Part of the Frog Pants Network. Get more at frogpants.com.